From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point. 50 years ago, American school children may have put their hands to their hearts and pledged allegiance to the idea of one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. But the country's cities were exploding in anger, protest, civil unrest. A presidential commission came out with the so-called Kerner Report. It concluded poverty and racism were largely the cause, and memorably, it charged white institutions with the creation and maintenance of America's ghettos and called for big changes. 50 years later, there's a new report. This hour on Point, the Kerner Report then and America now. You can join us on air or online. Whoever's old enough to remember the summer of 1967, raise your hand and tell us, what was it like then? Are we a better, fairer, more equal country today? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first from Washington is Alan Curtis, president and CEO of the Milton Eisenhower Foundation. He's worked for 5 decades on the challenges of racism and poverty. Back then, he co-directed another presidential commission that looked into the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy. Now he's co-edited the new report, a new Kerner report, you might say. It's just out. It's called Healing Our Divided Society. Alan Curtis, welcome to On Point.
Ray, good to talk with you again.
Well, looking back to what the Kerner Commission reported and looking at the assessment that Healing Our Divided Society gives us now on the 50th anniversary of the Kerner Commission report, how are we doing?
Well, the Kerner Commission said America was heading towards two societies, black and white, separate and unequal. And it focused on inequality, on poverty, on racial injustice. Today, 50 years later, it's fair enough to say we've made some progress. We have had our first African-American president elected 2 terms. The Latino and African-American middle class has expanded. Latino and African-American legislators have greatly expanded. Most of your audience probably has been to see Black Panther. So you can identify progress. On the other hand, since the Kerner Commission, child poverty has increased. Since the Kerner Commission, deep poverty, the poorest of the poor, have increased. Wealth inequality has increased. Income inequality has increased. Zero tolerance, which is racially biased, has failed. The prison system had 200,000 people in 1968 at the time of the Kerner Commission. It has now 1.4 million people in prison, and they are disproportionately minorities. And in some ways, it's fair to say that prison building has become our national housing policy for the poor.
Well, do we have a tendency to look at the successes that are overt and obvious, like the election of a black president, and let that distract us from what some of the numbers tell us that you've just been citing?
Well, you're right, and we do have a tendency to do what you said, and we should acknowledge progress. But the world is a gray world, full of contradictions, and that's what we're dealing with in America today. We say, look at these trends that have been going in the wrong direction, and at least take heart in the fact that since the Kerner Commission, we've learned a great deal about what works and what doesn't work. And so what we in Healing Our Divided Society are saying is that we should identify what works and scale it up and finance the scaling up by scaling down what doesn't work.
Again and again in the latest report, there are echoes of what the original 1968 report had to say about the shape of the society in the United States. And I'm struck by the findings from March 1st, 1968, that bemoan the fact that black Americans were not
graduating from high school at a high enough rate. The gap was yawning and enormous between black high school graduation and white high school graduation. In 1968, it was recommended that more people finish high school, that more people head to college. One of the great successes in the data says, yes, black kids in America who finish high school at a tremendous rate now go on in unprecedented numbers to college. And for all that, the gaps in income and wealth have hardly narrowed, in some cases widened.
They have. So, again, we should celebrate the successes, but the differences continue. In addition to what you just said, the rate of African-American unemployment has been twice as high as the rate of white unemployment for the past 50 years. We've had different business cycles and different eras of growth, but the 2-to-1 ratio has continued. And that's not right, and that's not just.
It's almost like the two lines move in tandem, somehow tied to each other. Black unemployment doesn't go down unless white unemployment is going down as well. There's no closing of the gap, because it starts to go up again when overall unemployment, including that of the white majority, goes up. You don't improve your relative position, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
And that's why we're saying that we need, in terms of policy, demand-side job creation, where we undertake much more substantial job training and link it to placement in actual employment, so that we don't have this kind of gap, and so that all Americans are allowed the opportunity to have a job. That's the case in other countries. Why can't it be the case in America?
One of the quotes from the original commission report that landed with an explosion on America's doorsteps was this: segregation and poverty have created in the racial ghetto a destructive environment totally unknown to most white Americans. What white Americans have never fully understood, but what the Negro can never forget, is that white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto. White institutions created it, white institutions maintain it, and white society condones it. That was strong, bracing stuff for 1968, wasn't it?
It was, and it continues to be strong, bracing stuff today. And so we recognize that reality, and we say that what we need to do is scale up what works. But we also say that in order to do that and to finance it, we need new political will. We didn't have new will. Those are words of the Kerner Commission in 1968, and we don't have new will today. So before we can really make progress, we need to communicate to the population that it is in the interest of many constituencies to embrace the kind of priorities of the Kerner Commission in terms of reducing poverty, inequality, and racial injustice. So that's what much of the report is concerned about.
It's interesting that you say that we didn't have will then, because we were in the midst of a tremendous increase in social spending. We were in the midst of the Great Society. In fact, Lyndon Johnson felt he didn't get enough credit for doing what he had done in the Kerner Commission report.
You're absolutely right. And there was, in fact, progress in the late 60s and early 70s towards meeting some of the kinds of goals we talk about in terms of reducing poverty and inequality. But then things later in the 70s and especially in the 80s changed and reversed themselves. Today, we find ourselves, therefore, in a situation where we do have regressions, where we have increases in child poverty and deep poverty. And in the richest country in the world, that's just not acceptable.
even though the Kerner Commission report text became a bestseller, went through more than 20 printings. Its policy recommendations are often described as having been shelved or forgotten. Was it the pace of events, the assassinations, the Tet Offensive? Was America just juggling too much stuff to take on the very ambitious goals laid out by the Kerner Commission report?
Well, I'm not so sure. I think there was progress. The Vietnam War complicated the political agenda and didn't allow for the focus on domestic reform. But I think in the 70s, Watergate created a sense that the federal government, the public sector, was not to be trusted. And it has taken a while to get back to the notion that if we are going to address the American dilemma, if we are going to focus on poverty and inequality, the public sector does need to finance what works, even though a lot of the actual day-to-day implementation can be carried out by nonprofit organizations in truly disadvantaged communities.
Is there a lasting impact that self-assessment 50 years ago today leaves us?
It reminds us that we can't be complacent. We made some progress. We have a long ways to go. So the news has to be day to day and hour to hour and minute to minute now. But someone has to take a step back and say, well, how have things been going over the long run? And what, therefore, should we be doing in the future?
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the Kerner Commission report, and we're taking stock of how far we've come in fixing the poverty, the racism, the injustices that led to riots and protests in our cities in that long, hot summer of 1967. Join the conversation. Where are we today? On racial equality, on income equality? Are things getting better? Are we building to a new boiling point? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest is Alan Curtis, president and CEO of the Milton Eisenhower Foundation and co-editor of a new report called Healing Our Divided Society. While Alan Curtis has been offering the bird's eye view, I'd like to bring in the Reverend Tracy Blackman, who perhaps brings ground truth. Executive Minister of Justice and Local Church Ministries for the United Church of Christ, and Senior Pastor of Christ the King Church in Florissant, Missouri. And she joins us from St. Louis. Reverend Blackman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for having me.
Well, when you look at the pages of Healing Our Divided Society, when you hear some of the overview conclusions about how we're doing, does it ring true in a community that's been riven by racial conflict in and around St. Louis?
It does, Ray, and it is shockingly similar that the conditions that we face today are very much like those that we faced 50 years ago. I was listening to the segment before me, and certainly it is true that we have made progress in some areas, but for the vast majority of people who live at the intersection of race and poverty, the landscape remains the same. And so it saddens me that we haven't come further along than we have.
If you look at the reports from various social science researchers, opinion researchers, Gallup, Pew, and others, they ask white people every year whether things are getting better. And the divergence between their answers and the answers of African Americans about the state of the country, about the racial climate in the country, about whether or not being black is a handicap. There's always been a split, but the divergence in recent years has been getting wider and wider. Why that split view, that almost mutually contradictory understanding of the state of play in America?
Well, in my opinion, Ray, it's has multiple factors. As was reported in the original Kerner report, there's no one reason that we're in the condition that we're in. But in response to your question, I would list a couple of factors. First and foremost is the invisibility of the poor. We are a nation that has begun to criminalize poverty, and we do that whether you are black or white. Clearly, poverty is not exclusive to the black community. This is also the 50th anniversary year of the assassination of Dr. King, and the next phase of his movement was to be to address this least common denominator, which is that of economic oppression. So, the invisibility of the poor, the fact that there are so many people who have been elevated in terms of class, there are so many white people who can live their entire lives and not really have to encounter directly the poverty that is at the intersection of race and economics. That's one reason that our reports are different. In this invisibility of the poor, a strange phenomenon has happened. We have elevated the exceptions as an example. So, yes, we had had a black president that is indeed monumental. He was a black president that was educated in the Ivy League, who lived a solidly at least middle class life, if not upper middle class life. He is an exception in that regard, but we've made him the example. And so when poverty is invisible, when you don't have relationships with those who live at that margin, and what you see are examples like President Barack Obama, those others who have elevated into political office, into academic office, who have been successful in a capitalistic world, then we began to ask the question, well, if we have these people who are examples of what can happen, then why can't that be the reality for everyone? It must be their own fault. And we began to make villains or demonize those who are living in abject poverty, a condition that didn't start with this generation, didn't start recently, but as we can see even 50 years ago in the Kerner report, was already in place. We have made progress, significant progress, but our response to the racialized and economic oppression of this nation has not equaled the depth of the depravity that we have entered into. And until the response equals the depth of despair, we will not come out of this.
The Reverend Tracy Blackman is Executive Minister for Justice and Local Church Ministries for the United Church of Christ. She joins me along with Alan Curtis, President and CEO of the Milton Eisenhower Foundation. Last July, CBS correspondent Michelle Miller looked back 50 years to the riots that erupted in Detroit in the summer of 67.
It began early one Sunday morning in late July. Police raided an unlicensed bar in a black neighborhood in Detroit. A crowd gathered. Tempers flared.
This is going to happen all over America. It's going to be a hot world, not a hot summer. It's a hot world.
A rock was thrown, and the city became a war zone.
From CBS News, joining us from Detroit, Michigan, Aaron, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I was here in Detroit, and I was a young teenager, 13 years old. And I remember distinctly what was going on before and during and after. And it's very similar to what's going on now. The communication industry was advancing things, and people were finding out more and being able to communicate more like it is now. And it was harder to hide what was going on. It's hard to miss something when you don't know about it. But blacks were beginning to find out what they had been missing, and they started to get angry, and the gaps that were economically obvious to most people started becoming obvious to blacks, and then the abuse of the powers to be, like the police department in Detroit, and the atrocities that were happening all over the country. People had started getting real tired of it. Even very liberal whites were getting very tired of it. And so it was a powder keg waiting to happen, and certain things happened that set it off. I was personally and directly affected. My oldest brother, who was the hope of my family, was slaughtered in front of his kids in his house by the Detroit police, and that altered my life permanently, and it was a part of what was going on. But what I'd like to say before I get off the line is that we talk about the progress that has been made, and it's an illusion. Because what has changed is we have blacks making more money and able to live different places, but the gaps have not been shortened between blacks and white. It's just been changed. The things that we do as a race for the society has just been altered. The rate of pays have been altered, but the gaps are still the same, if not larger. And so it's an illusion of progress when really things have just changed how we do what we do, but the same things are going on, and people are starting to get tired of it again because of the advancements in communication and how we can no longer hide behind the ignorance of what's going on or lack of communication of what's going on. The Internet is a major part of that, so I don't think we're doing very well at all. I think we're getting worse, actually.
Aaron, thanks a lot for your call from Detroit. It's important to remember the large number of people who died in those urban riots, shot by police, shot by National Guardsmen, also dying in accidents, dying in fires. A lot of lives were lost during the summer of 67. And also, our caller reminds us of the damage. When you tour the neighborhoods that were most heavily affected, in Detroit, in Newark, in Cleveland, in Chicago, it took decades for those neighborhoods to come back. The chronic disinvestment that already was plaguing some of these parts of American cities became really manifest when they were damaged, needed an infusion of capital to come back, and they just didn't get it. In a book I wrote in the late 90s, I noted that some of the places that had held buildings and homes in the part of Cleveland just east of downtown that burned in the riots had mature trees, the trunks so large you couldn't get your arms around them, growing in the empty lots that had been created by the riots. Roxbury, Massachusetts is next. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ray. Welcome.
Nice to have you on, James.
I wanted to mention something that's never brought up, and that's the excessive number of young black men who were died or maimed in Vietnam, a disproportionate number. That affected the community immensely. You know, and that was at the same time that the anti-poverty program failed and the war on drugs started. And there's also an increase now in poverty on all levels, and this is being used by politicians to drive people apart, you know, saying that these people are taking your jobs or your place in society. These are things that aren't mentioned, and they're happening and throughout, you know, the panoramic view of 50 years, and these are great things that greatly affect the community. And the last thing is gentrification, which started in the 70s.
You know, James, Vietnam was really cranking by 1967. The American commitment was rising, and certainly black and brown men weren't able to take advantage of college deferments in quite the same way as a lot of white young fellas were. But was the reaction politicized? In a place like Roxbury, were people saying, hey, we're the ones who are heading off to Southeast Asia?
Yeah, all types of people were being picked up off the streets. There weren't any people hanging around because they were in the service.
And there was a sense of that the men of the neighborhood were heading off to war.
Oh yeah, that happened, and you know, and I was part of that, you know, that caste system they had, because I could go to college, and a lot of my friends couldn't, or they didn't know how to, because the schools weren't really giving them guidance.
James, thanks a lot for your call from Roxbury, Mass. Alan Curtis, it is important to remember just what the country was like, and not everybody has a copy of the Kerner Commission report close to hand as we do today's program on its 50th anniversary. But a lot of things were intersecting right at that moment, both the Great Society and the rise in American commitment in the Vietnam War and the deindustrialization of the heart of a lot of American cities. There were a lot of young men who were unemployed and underemployed. A powder keg, really.
It was a powder keg, and the gaps that your listeners and have discussed are real. But I would just like to say that in spite of those gaps, there is some sense of hope. And that's because we've learned a great deal about what works if we only had political will. So, for example, there was such police abuse in Detroit, and there has been such police abuse in Ferguson. But there is community-based policing in which officers, especially officers of color, cooperate and partner with community-based organizations at the grassroots. And those partnerships can create a sense of security that can encourage community-based banking, which can encourage community development corporations to build low-income housing, which can employ young people of color if they have adequate job training. And so when you look at what works based on the last 50 years, you see that there are often place-based multiple solutions which provide comprehensive and interdependent solutions. So the question then again becomes, we have a lot of knowledge. The problem is not lack of knowledge. The problem is lack of political will.
Reverend Blackmun, during these same years, the walls of the ghetto were reducing in height, let's say. Mobile people, people with educations, people with a union job in an industrial factory somewhere that was going to stick in its city, they were able to buy houses outside the traditional area that had been set aside for black residents before that. The most mobile people, the most aspirational people, left, and in an almost paradoxical way, created an even deeper and more concentrated poverty in the neighborhoods they left behind. How does that look in 2018?
Well, we certainly see the negative impact of that upward mobilization based on class. I want to say that this is not an issue that's not solvable, that I agree that there is hope. And I agree with the statement that what we lack is will. A colleague of mine reminded me just earlier today that 20 years prior to the Kerner's report, that the United States invested a large sum of money in European countries after World War II to bring them back, to restore. I want to say again that we cannot solve this problem without an investment that matches the depth of despair. Generations of racism, of racist policy, of oppression based on color of skin, of economic deprivation, cannot be given just a little token and expect people to survive. There are some who will make it out, and those are the people that we make examples of when they are really exceptions to what is happening in our society.
But very quickly, so, given the tenor of the times, is that kind of commitment likely? Given the attitudes
not.
People have right now.
It is not. And that's why people like myself and other activists have to continue to sound the clarion call, because until we do that, we will continue to experience these wide gaps that are getting larger. I'll tell you, there is another glimmer of hope that I have about this, is that we are beginning to see the convergence outside of race of people who are being economically oppressed. And when the majority of people, black and white and brown, begin to feel the full impact of economic oppression, then I believe there will be a rising up of the people that will change the narrative of this country.
Reverend Blackmun, stay with us. We're talking about how far we've come and not come in making this country less separate, less unequal. Alan Curtis, I'll say goodbye to you now. We spent the day together on the 30th anniversary of the report. I think on the 50th I had hopes that things would be better, but thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to the 75th.
I hope we're both here for it. Alan Curtis is president and CEO of the Milton Eisenhower Foundation. I'm Ray Suarez. It's On Point.
Before we get back to the show, we'd like to ask you about you. That's right. We want to learn more about our listeners with a short survey. It's anonymous and easy. Just go to wbur.org/survey to complete the survey right now. That's wbur.org/survey. This survey will be tremendously helpful to us. So thanks.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about the findings of a new report on race and economic class in America today, and what we should do to build out the black and white middle class to address the poverty and poor education that still dogs us. You can join the conversation. Do you see a conservative solution, a bipartisan solution, a progressive solution? My guest is the Reverend Tracy Blackman, Executive Minister of Justice and Local Church Ministries for the United Church of Christ and Senior Pastor of Christ the King Church in Florissant, Missouri. Joining us now from Washington is Ben Domenech. He's publisher of the online journal The Federalist. Ben, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Well, Healing Our Divided Society looks at the 50 years since the Kerner Commission report and has a lot of discouraging news. When you look at America, what do you see?
Well, I think it's important, Ray, to begin with facts and with data. And I understand, you know, that you've just let Mr. Curtis go, which is, I think, unfortunate, because I wanted to respond to the very first point that he made, which is he started this interview with you by saying that the child poverty rate has gone up since the original Kerner report. That's simply not true. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which is a nonpartisan but progressive-leaning think tank in Washington, reported last year that the child poverty rate hit historic lows. In fact, it was cut almost in half. In 1967, the child poverty rate in America was 28.4%. It's down to 15% as of last year, and it fell across all ethnicities. This is something that happened not just due to increased growth in terms of wages and other factors, but it actually included progressive policies. The war on poverty actually had a significant impact, as well as the child tax credit, the earned income tax credit, increases in food stamps and in terms of other entitlements. And that ended up cutting the percentage of children in America who live in poverty in half over the course of the past half century. Now, is that still a problem that we have essentially 11 million children in America who live below the poverty line? Of course it is, and it's something that needs to be addressing. But we shouldn't exaggerate the degree to which things have failed to shift in the past half century. The fact is that we've seen improvements in the experience of nearly every sector of the American economy, and in terms of the outlook of Americans today. The Pew Research Center found just last year that the people who are most optimistic about economic growth in America are actually blacks and Latinos. 72% of Latinos believe that their children will be better off financially than they themselves are now. They express the most optimism about the way things are going in the American economy. And in fact, it's white Americans who are the most pessimistic about their economic future, which is frankly one of the reasons I believe that we have the president that we have in the White House today. That white Americans believed that they were losing economic agency and pessimistic about the direction that the nation's economy was going. I believe it's important to look at these issues and to value the things that we hear from people who are on the ground and experiencing these various things. But at the same time, we need to look at this as a holistic matter and take the data as it comes and not simply, I think, play up the worst experiences in America and forget how bad things really were at the end of the 1960s.
I'm glad you made that correction to the absolute rate of child poverty. Elsewhere in the new report, Healing Our Divided Society, there's breakouts for what the report calls absolute poverty, which is family incomes less than half the poverty line. And that's a stubborn and persistent number. There are also reports outside of Healing Our Divided Society that say that the barriers are hardening, that class mobility is becoming more difficult. If you're born in the first or second quintile, the likelihood that you'll end up in the fourth or fifth is declining, that you'll spend any time in the third is declining. That's discouraging, and it's real, I think.
I think it is real, and it is very discouraging. Let's talk about, you know, what that really is about. From my perspective, that is more than anything else about the issue of education in America. The fact is that we spend more than $600 billion annually in terms of the world. That puts us in the top three countries in per pupil spending, and yet achievement has been essentially flat since the 1970s, even as federal funds for education have tripled. There's really no correlation between the states that spend significant amounts of money and the states that don't in terms of student achievement. For instance, I'm joining you from Washington, D.C. today, where they spend over $30,000 per student when considering all the different funding streams, which is practically the tuition of one of, you know, the best private schools that you could find, and yet their achievement continues to lag. It is very disappointing, and you have rampant corruption, which has led in the past couple of weeks to the resignations of a number of different D.C. school officials. I think we have a significant problem with K through 12 education in America, and clearly the issue is not just funding. It's the kind of education that students are receiving, particularly students who are experiencing it in an urban environment. We must improve that in order to have these kinds of boundaries that you're talking about in terms of firming up those class lines be eliminated.
Ben Domenech joins me from Washington. He's the publisher of The Federalist. He's here along with the Reverend Tracy Blackman from the United Church of Christ. Manchester, Connecticut is our next stop. Tom, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how you doing?
Okay.
I was a junior high school student when it happened in 68. I remember it being the tumultuous year, the assassination of Dr. King 2 months later with Robert F. Kennedy, who probably made a difference in it versus Richard Nixon with the Southern strategy and, I guess, trying to blame blacks for the problems, and also with, at the time, counterintelligence program. If you were black, I would say radical, but spoke out against truth, whether it be the Black Panthers or other individuals, James Baldwin, you were put on this list that's unfortunately happening again under the Trump administration with Attorney General Sessions about looking at black activists. Also, I agree with Mr. Domenech that we've made some progress in some ways, but you have to look at sometimes residential segregation and how students are taught. It takes, you know, a relationship between that and the parents, but sometimes I think classism can get in the way. And also, we got to talk about poor rural right areas. They're suffering too in terms of education. They don't go on to college or just go into the service. So I believe in, you know, progressive trends, but where do we go from here? Because I hear like the name calling, like Brainy Heart liberal, snowflake on one side, racist conservative on the other side, but can we get to the middle ground and stop using, you know, Dr. King as an icon for both sides, but make his dream reality? Because I'm glad that Atlantic Monthly has recognized his teachings. That's out for the next couple of months, a special edition. But beyond his death and others, as a black educated college person with three degrees, I'm proud of who I am. I do what I can in Manchester and progressive ways of helping out in the education system, such as for our State Board of Education in Connecticut. They just put a report about how they can reach Latino black students. But also, I'm wondering about other marginalized groups. If you're Arab American, of Islamic faith, of Hispanic, mixed race, or LGBT, you know, there's discrimination going on there and name calling. So I think this goes beyond race and class, but it's sexual orientation, gender quality. I think there's still been problems with harassment, but some women have made, you know, gains in different ways. But we are at a turning point. If we're the beacon to the rest of the world, we have to, you know, start at home and stop, I guess, sometimes blaming the victim for the homelessness and poverty. And that includes even helping out, you know, homeless veterans. But it's almost like the HUD director, Mr. Carson, what has he done with his walking tour? What about the cuts to HUD, the stamp, food stamp program, or SNAP? Now you got Harvest Basket. They're cutting back on that. Mental health coverage after these shootings. And I feel like, you know, the threats that have happened here in Connecticut, you know, after that tragic shooting 2 weeks ago in Florida, most of the shooters have been, you know, white males. So when they talk about the black predator from almost 30 years ago, I mean, you know, look in the mirror. We still got a rise in hate groups when we had Mr. Obama there, who tried to be president for everyone, but he was called the N-word by the governor of Maine, who never apologized. So,
well, Tom, let me stop you there, because you're giving us a tremendous load of things to talk about, and I want to unpack a little bit of that with my guest. Thank you for your call from Manchester, Connecticut. Both Tom and Ben Domenech, Reverend Blackman, have brought up education. We spend a lot of money on education. It's not – the problem is not that we're not spending enough money. The numbers tell us that minority students are graduating from high school at much improved rates. But are they as qualified, are they as knowledgeable as the high school graduate of another generation? Is the quality – is what we're asking for from a graduating 12th grader what we were asking for in the 60s?
Yes, I agree that we do spend quite a bit of money on education, but education does not stand alone. What we're talking about is the need to improve the entire life of the students that we send to school. If you have children who are going to schools from economically deprived areas, they are not going to school with the intellectual freedom, the capacity to learn in the same way that those who don't have those issues at home are going to school. The bottom line is this country spends money where it needs to spend money on what it values, and what it does not value are poor black and brown people. Yes, you can have $30,000 a student, and we could call that equality across the road, across the bridge of those who are more advantaged than others. But what is the starting point? This is not a conversation simply about equality. It's a conversation about equity. What is the investment that this country needs to make things equitable for those who are suffering from generations of racial and economic oppression?
I think, Reverend Blackman, you're making a social capital-based argument, that even though they're both five, two entering kindergartners aren't necessarily starting the race in the same exact position. And if you come from a home with fewer books, no magazine subscriptions, no high-speed internet connection, no computer, Ben Domenech, you are objectively at a different point in the race, yet we worship at the altar of equality, and most American kids go to public schools, and we think if we give them the same things, we'll get the same results. But we don't.
Well, you also start at a different point if you come from a home that only has one parent, which is something that I think, you know, is frankly a bigger factor here than, you know, any of the others that we could mention. In terms of the stability of your home life, you know, one of the reasons that I think we've seen, you know, the degradation and frankly the difficulties that have been plaguing working-class white Americans is because of the falls that we've seen in terms of the family stability of those communities. I think that's true across the board, and certainly true if you inhabit a community that doesn't have the strong social ties that you see in certain other minority groups in America, particularly in various Asian communities. But speaking to the last caller's point, he brought up the issue of housing. And I think that one of the things that we really need to look at is the issue of linking housing to where you are taught and where you go to school. For poor families of any color in America, it's difficult to buy houses in good school districts. And the fact is that those school districts that they are often locked into don't have to deal with competitive situations in terms of where those kids could go. That's something that I think in terms of the Washington, D.C. experience, you know, has been a significant problem for the public school systems here. Imagine, if you will, Ray, if we bought grocery store access along with our mortgages. It would be actually a very stupid idea. No one would take it for granted, and yet we take for granted in America that you are going to be forced to go to a particular school based on the city block where you live. I think that one of the things that we need to look at hard in America is the level of competition that's needed in order to offer our children the education that they're going to need to survive in a thriving global economy, in an advancing world where China and other nations are looking increasingly like economic powerhouses who can truly compete with the United States on a level that hasn't been true in previous decades. That's something that I think we really need to get a handle on in America. And unfortunately, the politics of those issues and the locked-in constraints around them really do, I think, prevent the kind of needed and aggressive reform that we ought to have in America when it comes to education.
I'm glad you brought up housing, because it does have a tremendous amount of input into where you go to school. It also has a tremendous amount of input into accumulated family wealth. And even when you correct for years in the workplace and level of education, there is a persistent and wide gap between black and white wages in the same category of labor. If you're doing the same job for the same number of years, there's a gap between black and white workers. There's a gap between what black and white workers can buy in the housing market, which, as you say, ends up feeding into what kind of houses they can buy. Half the kids in America go to school where their education costs are in part underwritten by the value of their family's home. And what kind of situation is that when you're reproducing the inequality of past generations in the next generation by basing how much money gets spent on the tools and the resources for school based on whether or not your parents can afford an expensive house or not? I mean, this is a pretty complicated and tightly tied set of knots, but those gaps that remain between black and white workers end up having input, end up having feedback into all kinds of realms of life. Let me give you some of our feedback from our listeners online. Argo writes, "We have had progress. However, problems that were overt then have become covert now. This is dangerous to kids who do not understand the racism in the world they live in, growing up with a false view of equality." And Lindam writes, "I just finished rereading W.E.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folks, first published in 1903. The thing that struck me was his insight into what needed to happen to eliminate the issues we faced." Ben Domenech is publisher of the online journal The Federalist. Ben, thanks for your thoughts.
Great to be with you.
And the Reverend Tracy Blackman is Executive Minister of Justice and Local Church Ministries for the United Church of Christ. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Ray.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.